Great trial lawyers are made, not born. Welcome to Verdict Academy, preserving trial wisdom for trial lawyers. Join host Kevin Morrison, trial attorney in San Francisco, as he recreates those invaluable hallway conversations that remote work has made rare. Candid insights and hard-won lessons from America's most accomplished trial lawyers. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Welcome, everybody, to Verdict Academy. Our guest this week is Daniel J. Kelly, one of my favorite people and favorite attorneys. Dan needs no introduction, but having said that, let me say a few words about him. He is in the Big Four invitation-only organizations of BODA, International Society of Barristers, where he served as president, the American College, of course, and IETL. He is a legend here in San Francisco. He has not only been the president of a San Francisco chapter of BODA, he's received both our highest awards, the Don Bailey Civility and Professionalism Award, as well as the Legends Award, which you have to be on this side of the grass long enough to receive. Dan is a Bay Area native. I believe he's born and raised in the North Bay, and then went to school, educated both undergrad and law school in the South Bay, a big part of the Santa Clara community down there in law school. And then he was only able to hold one legal job his whole career at Walkup, where he probably was a partner for, I don't know, 30 years or something, one of the best firms in the history of California. Dan is an excellent trial attorney, and not only that, is an author in the field. There are many times when I relied on his three-volume Rudder Guide personal injury guidebook, which probably got me through more than one malpractice situation, so I didn't know what the statute was or didn't know which side of the V to send the discovery to. So Dan Kelly, thank you so much for being a guest here on Verdict Academy today.
Thank you, Kevin. I almost believed everything you said about my qualifications, but thank you.
Absolutely. Do I have that right? You spent your whole career at Walkup?
Yes, that's correct. Over 50 years. Not only that, I mean, it's the same building. I parked my car in the same garage for 50 years. Fortunately, it was not the same car all that 50 years. There is something about stability, I guess, in my background. I didn't make many career moves. I think the biggest move was when we moved from the 30th floor to the 26th floor in terms of they were abating asbestos. And so four floors, that's my career move in 50 years. So,
love it. That says a lot. You're obviously a thoughtful guy. You're a great writer. You wrote some great articles in Plaintiff Magazine about the practice of law. How did you decide, or how was it that you became a courtroom trial attorney?
Well, I actually started off in law school. There were a group of us who thought we were going to be trial lawyers. I think I'm the only one on to do that. But we piled in a car and came to San Francisco. We were in the second year of law school. We did it both the second year and third year, and went to the Nate Cohn seminar. And Nate had assembled James Martin McGinnis, Mel Belli, Jake Ehrlich, I mean, the cream of the crop in terms of trial lawyers, and it was a full day. And we did it again in my third year of law school. And I was really impressed with these lawyers. I mean, they seemed to be comfortable in their skin. They had great fun among each other. They put on instructive programs and the like. And I thought, you know, I'd like to do that. Then I had a tax professor who said that the highest paid lawyers that he had worked with in terms of tax law were plaintiff's personal injury lawyers. And so I thought, well, that sounds pretty good as well. So anyway, it was a combination of those two that kind of led me in that direction. Plus my father, over the years, he and I would get in, not arguments, but we'd debate a little bit. And he'd always close by saying, you know, I think you ought to be a lawyer. So, yeah, it came to fruition with all of those things combined. So,
yeah. And yeah, of course, you get to the Walkup firm. And what year did you start there, Dan?
I started in 1969. I came on board. I actually wrote a brief to the California Supreme Court when I hadn't been yet. I was waiting bar results, and I wrote this thing. And it just so happened it was an AC brief. I couldn't even sign the thing, because I wasn't a lawyer. And Dave Harney was involved in the case, and Bill Camusi, and a lot of big-name lawyers. were involved in this thing. And I guess the word got back to Bruce Walkup. This brief was really well written. I won't mention names, but the guy that signed it took all the credit for the brief. And I guess at lunch one time, one of my contemporaries said to Bruce Walkup, no, he didn't write it. The new kid did. And so I was called in and Bruce Walkup said, did you write the brief in Marzango? And I didn't know. My whole career, I thought, was shot right there. And I said, yes, I did. And the next day, there was a memo. And I was to be his associate and not the associate of the guy that signed the brief. So it all kind of came together that way. And, you know, that's how I really started work with Bruce Walkup, one-on-one.
You were basically, you worked with him until he retired. Is that, do I have that right?
Actually, first 3 or 4 years, we tried a lot of cases together. And then it was kind of one of these things, well, you're on your own. And that happened in, first happened in a case in Utah, where we had the wonderful experience of suing the Mormon church that owned the hospital. And we drew a Mormon judge and so on. And so I think Bruce said, why don't you handle this from here on out? So I tried that case and it resolved in terms of a settlement in the second week. And then it was kind of like, okay, well, you've been in the water long enough and you know how to swim, so you're going to be swimming on your own. So off I went.
It's the way to do it. Build up that scar tissue. Dan, you know, the purpose of the podcast basically is a couple of things. You know, since the pandemic, maybe before that, but the pandemic certainly accelerated folks working from home and less interaction in the office. So we want to kind of reinstill a little bit of the old water cooler talk. And so believing in the rule of threes, I understand there's three things we want to talk about in today's podcast for our busy trial attorneys out there. One is case selection. One is losing and how do you get past losing. The third is kind of the use of expert witnesses. Let's kind of talk about those one at a time. Case selection. Tell me about your views on how to select a case and the importance of that for a young trial attorney out there.
Well, of interest to me, recently I read an article where somebody was talking about it. They have an algorithm in their firm, and that tells them whether to take the case or not. And it's all done through paralegals interviewing clients. And to me, that's completely foreign. I wanted to sit down and meet with the client firsthand. I mean, this is somebody, plaintiff's world, you're going to be trying to sell a jury on the quality of this person. And it's a world of first impressions. So if your first impression is this is not a saleable commodity, you know, you can get used to them over the long haul and working with them. But the first impression is still very important. And that's something I think the lawyer has to get a hold of. The other thing is you cannot have any client control as far as I'm concerned, not ever meeting the client. And as you know, Kevin, tail end of my career, I was doing a lot of mediations. And sadly, sometimes the first thing I had to do was introduce the plaintiff to their attorney at the mediation. And that doesn't bode well. I mean, I always said that I think a plumber gets more respect than a lawyer. I mean, if the plumber came in and said, hey, you got a U-joint underneath the sink and it's this, that, and the other thing, you'd say, okay, fine, fix it, so on. With a lawyer, they're skeptics. And if they don't meet you until the tail end of the case, it's a little tough to establish appropriate client control. And you really have to, you know, instruct the client along the way. I mean, in terms of appearance, a trial, all kinds of things like that. And if you've never met them, how can you instill confidence in them at the last minute? So to me, it's extremely important to meet with, talk to, and get some idea of what this person's all about. And the other thing is, people think lawyers are, you know, oh, we're advocates and we're this, that, and the other thing. When I first started practicing, I said, attorney counselor, there's a big component of counseling people. They've never experienced things with lawyers. This is the first thing for them. And there is counseling, and particularly in plaintiff's cases of people that have suffered a loss, either be it a family member or a tragic injury or whatever. And so counseling to me starts right from the get-go.
It's really the most rewarding thing of what we do, isn't it? Meeting these folks who've gone through some of the worst, probably the worst time of their life or one of the worst times of their life, and getting to know them and working with them and getting through that time together.
Yes. And I must say, I think you have to be honest with them. I told people that if your heart went out to everybody, and it does when you see these people and what they've been through, but you can only put so much out there. And they have to understand that. I would talk to them and understand their grief, their sorrow, their loss, whatever, but also tell them, I'm not here just to mouth platitudes. I'm here to represent you and do the best job we can. And we can only do that working together. So again, I go back to the human experience of sitting down talking to people.
You know, there's so much pressure on our time. We're all so busy, and it sounds so inconvenient to leave the office and get in your car or whatever and go visit your client at his or her home. But every time I've done that, I've come away from that meeting a way better lawyer, a way better person, a way better advocate for that client.
Exactly. And I think it works the other way too. They come out of this appreciating the lawyer, appreciating the counseling, and being able to rely on that lawyer and what they say on down the line as the case progresses.
Great point. Let's talk about everybody's favorite topic, certainly for plaintiffs' lawyers, and that's losing. Because we always like to tout our losses. Tell me about losing, Dan, and how do you get through a loss?
Well, the first case I really tried was against Dick Siggins, like Goodmanson, Siggins, and Stone. Great guy. And I lost. And so I got that out of my system pretty early in my career. I think I shared with you, Kevin, that I think the next case was Dan McNamara. And then there was another named partner. Francis Carroll from Carroll, Burdick, and McDonough. And suddenly I realized, you know, I'm not trying cases against my peers. I'm trying cases against these named partners. So I lost the first one. I've lost others. And quite frankly, it's not easy to lose. I mean, nobody likes to lose. And are you going to have a psychological trauma because you lost the case? I mean, there are so many things that happen in trial that you and I both know you have no control over. I always said, try to get help from within and not from without. And by that, I mean, to me, it was like exercise. You know, I could go work out and kind of get through things. And I think when you talk about working from within, sweat comes from within. Other people try to get over that by drinking or the use of drugs. In other words, things from without. And it doesn't work. I mean, those things may have a temporary solution, but they have no future. Nor will anybody that relies on those things. You have to forgive yourself. And somebody once said that the person that's most difficult to forgive is yourself. You know, so you can't sit there and you must learn from what you've done. And maybe a reason you lost, you have to analyze it and then move on. I mean, you have to get back on the horse, basically. And I do know some lawyers that fell off the horse and never got back on.
Because of a loss.
Yeah, and also fell off the horse and fell off the wagon, you know.
Well, there's so much pressure, and especially, you know, I started practicing in the early 90s, so I kind of saw maybe towards the end of your career, now we're in the mid-20s, you know, 30 years later. There's so much media and so much publicity about, you know, these big 7, 8, 9 figure verdicts, and everybody touts on the billboards or TV ads or on the internet how successful everybody is. And so now if you try a case and lose or get a bad result, you feel less than because you're not measuring up to all what the media or what social media is saying about what successful plaintiffs' lawyers are doing.
Yeah, and that's a whole new world. At least from where I was to what you're talking about now. I mean, I see on TV somebody's examining a witness and takes a water glass and breaks it in his hand. I mean, I guess people at home think that's what lawyers do, you know, and it's tough. It's tough to overcome that. And as you say, have the pressure. Also, you have the pressure now of costs. I mean, the cost burden of these cases is not what it was way back when. And I wrote an article where I talked about packing up my briefcase after a trial, and I put a footnote. Yes, it was possible to try a case using a briefcase, not 47 boxes, et cetera, et cetera. But nowadays, it's a whole new world and, you know, electronic world. Let me just tell you one thing. You know, I never was comfortable using all this state-of-the-art stuff. State-of-the-art for me was an overhead projector. I plugged one in San Jose, and the power went out on a six-floor courthouse. The power went out. The next time I thought I was being such a genius with high-tech stuff was something as sophisticated as a slide projector, and I put the slide in, and it caught on fire. After those two incidents, I thought, maybe I shouldn't fool around with stuff that I have no understanding of and resort to posters and diagrams and that type of thing. Sounds primitive, but for me, it worked. And if I got beyond my level of competence, I was in trouble.
Back to losses real quick. So you were trying cases in the 70s and 80s. And back then, people were trying cases with much more frequency. So let's say you lost a trial, you go down to the local watering hole, whatever it is, Sam's or, you know, whichever one it is around here. Would you talk about the loss? And were losses more viewed as, hey, that's what happens when you go to trial, you lose sometimes? I guess what I'm asking is, were people more willing to talk about the losses then because they were trying more cases? And of course, you're going to lose if you tried cases.
Yeah, I think that's true. And you mentioned, you know, there were like 12 or 14 of us in the office when I started in terms of lawyers. And we were a tight-knit group. And so before trial, you'd be talking about things and how do I do this? How do I do that? And then after trial, you know, we'd exchange info back and forth. There was no, I mean, you knew you lost. They knew you lost. They knew that you didn't feel good about it, but you have to get over it. And I had, I would say, a counseling group of about 12 other lawyers that you can say have been there, done that. Great lawyers. And they've all taken a flop. I mean, it just happens and you have to get over it.
Yeah. Not going to help a lot of clients if you stop practicing law after a loss, right? Future clients that need us, you're not going to help.
Yeah, exactly.
Sometimes it's just, this sounds kind of corny, but sometimes it's just the fight that matters. Sometimes you just need to go in and try a case. And if you lose it, you lose it. But it's just kind of helpful your client just to fight for him.
Oh, yeah. You see all these ads now on TV. I won't mention names, but one of these guys I did a mediation for, and he was touting about his great trial record. I said, if you've got that many trials, send me your list of trials, and I'll see if I can propose you for membership in a BOTA. I'm still waiting. And that's been 10 years ago. So I'm still waiting. And quite frankly, I had one lawyer come in and tell me, I wanted to hit him, quite frankly. He said, you know what this case is all about, Dan? And I said, no, what? I mean, tell me. I've read the facts and so on. But he said, well, this is a pump it and dump it. I said, what? And he said, yeah, you know what it is. It's in the trade. We call it pump it and dump it. I said, what are you talking about? And he said, well, you pump up the damages. You do this, that, pump it up, pump it up. And they know you're going to dump it. Well, yeah, that word gets around. The dump part of it gets around, believe me. And you have no credibility with insurance companies, defense counsel, so on, if that's your MO. And sadly, I think a lot of these people that tout themselves as trial lawyers, it would be like me saying I'm an expert in jet propulsion or something, ever having done that. So
fair enough. So moving on to our third topic here today, expert witnesses. I know you tried a lot of medical negligence cases, as I understand it, where experts, it can be important sometimes for a jury to make a determination. Talk to me about your philosophy on expert witnesses, Dan.
Well, it started out doing medical negligence cases. Most times you were so happy you even had an expert and who was willing to testify against a fellow physician. Sometimes they had to travel quite a ways to get there. I once had a neurologist testify who flew in from Miami. And I remember defense counsel asking him, how many neurologists do you think you flew over to get to California to testify here? But you had these experts, and I think the key was, and I soon learned, that you have to sometimes confront those experts with the tough questions that they're going to face either in deposition or trial. And, you know, as a young lawyer, you'd say, boy, I'm just happy I have this expert. I don't want to upset him. But you really have to probe and make sure they're ready and kind of locked and loaded. I think I told you, Kevin, back then I used the phonetics of what an expert is. I said an X is a has been and a spurt is a drip under pressure. And that seemed to kind of explain some of the people I saw as experts. So times have changed, but you know, a lot of these people are still phonies and have phony credentials or testify a lot. I sat as a judge pro tem many times, and you'd see experts come in. One guy, for example, I knew had testified probably 100 times for the defense and maybe twice for it. And it was mid-January, and he was asked how many times he testified for each side. He said, well, take this year, for example. And he said, it's been even. I've testified once for the plaintiff and once for the defense. And the lawyer accepted that. And I thought, you know, it's January and he's already testified twice. But anyway, you see people like that and they're out there and they crumble if handled appropriately by good lawyers in cross-examination.
Was your philosophy then when you'd retain an expert witness, would you go meet with that expert and make sure they understood and kind of do a mock cross with them to see how they withstood? Or how would you handle that to make sure they could hopefully withstand the cross-examination at trial when there's inevitably bad facts that are exposed?
Yeah, ideally, you would do just that, is meet with them, you go over things initially. I can give you an example of what I was going through as a plaintiff's lawyer. I retained an expert that was used by Dave Harney, and this is a Southern California expert, and he had reviewed everything. His secretary phoned me and said that he was ready, and he saw him. We scheduled his deposition. I flew down to L.A. He said, we just meet over lunch, and the deposition's at 2 o'clock. He opened the packet of records when I arrived at his office, and I thought, oh my God, he hasn't even reviewed this stuff. And somehow, in a candlelit restaurant, he was reading the records as I was almost choking over lunch. But, you know, he was my expert. What are you going to do? I think, to me, the two things that bothered me most, logistics, one, trying a case is not easy, making sure everything comes together and people show up on time. And the other thing was experts, because they can go sideways and often do. And hopefully you can get a hold of things from the get-go and not experience what I experienced an hour and a half before the deposition. So,
how about defense experts? What's your philosophy on defense experts? How would you handle those at trial? Would you go after bias issues? Would you try to get all the good stuff from them? Did you have a general philosophy as what you do with the defense experts?
Well, the first thing I would do is a lot of research before getting there. And I always thought if thine enemy had written something, you can get your hands on stuff. I watched Bruce Walkup one time cross-examine a radiologist, and the guy had turned the lights off to look at the films, a defense expert. And he spoke in a rather loud voice. In fact, the more you confronted him, the louder he got, on and on and on. Well, he had written an article in a radiology journal. And one of the things he concluded was that the average juror doesn't understand the difference between a radiologist and a radio repairman. And you don't need to turn the lights off to look at an X-ray, but it really impresses the jurors if you do so. On and on and on. And if you get really confronted, raise your voice, be more firm, that type of thing. So yeah, I watched these really good lawyers. And the first thing they did is they found out everything they could about the expert, and be that talking to other lawyers, finding out where they testified, so on, and doing your best armed with that type of stuff to cross-examine them.
Yeah, it's incredible sometimes how folks forget the articles they wrote and the positions they took when it was just a pure academic exercise. And then when the money gets paid to advocate a certain position, that seems to go out the window sometimes.
Yes, I must say, having co-authored the Rutter Group practice guide and serving as an expert witness maybe a dozen times, I can tell you that it works the other way, where you're sitting there trying to explain that I just wrote chapters 1, 3, 5, and 7, and you're talking about chapter 4, and I had nothing to do with chapter 4, that type of thing.
Well, that's great, Dan. You know, honestly, we're basically out of time, but is there any parting words, you know, you want to use or convey to some of our younger trial attorneys who are out there trying to make their way in this world?
I'd say taking advantage of things like this. I mean, education is the key. I told you at the get-go that I wanted to be a trial lawyer after watching top trial lawyers. And I also served as a juror in a case when I was in law school, and I saw it great. There was a fellow, Paul Dana, the old firm in San Francisco, was Dana Bledsoe. And he had defended against, I can't tell you, and he had a personal problem, alcoholism, so on, and recovered. And here he was in San Jose and defending a case. And I got to watch him firsthand. And I thought, holy Toledo, this is a trial lawyer. I talked to him afterwards. And he said, I was working, you know, had worked in city government before and didn't know what I was going to do afterwards. And he said, hey, trial lawyer, be a trial lawyer. And I thought, here's a trial lawyer telling me to be a trial lawyer. Then Bob Popelka in San Jose, I somehow was invited to their office Christmas party by a young secretary, as I recall. And there were like 4 men standing at the end of the cocktail party. And Popelka said to me, what are you doing here? Who are you? And I explained. And Bob said, be a trial lawyer. So, yeah, I mean, I had nice people around me all the time telling me those things. But I'll never forget when Bob Popelka was diagnosed with cancer. He would go to Mass every day. He did that after World War II and was a man of his word. But we showed up, trial lawyers. Members of the Ebota chapter went to San Jose, and we went to Mass, about 50 of us with Bob Pelkin. There's just kind of this down deep, I think we're good people, we're caring people, we're trying to do the best we can for clients that have sustained major losses. So I think a good part of what I would call lawyering, where you feel good afterwards. And as you say, it's not nice to lose, but that's another feeling and you have to cope with it.
Well, Daniel J. Kelly, you're a prince of a man and a giant in our profession, and I really appreciate the time you spent with us.
I think you got those reversed. The smallest prince you've ever seen, pal. Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you for listening to Verdict Academy. If today's insights resonated with you, please subscribe and share with colleagues. In a world where we see each other less, learning from experienced trial lawyers matters now more than ever. Join us next time. Produced and powered by LawPods.